Well, we want to thank you for tuning in to 88.5 KRFY this morning for the morning show. Your hearty folks out there. It's very snowy, and we're happy to be here. My name is Susie Prez, and I'm one of the hosts this morning, and my co-host, he made it in too.
Chris Bessler sitting over here at the second mic. How are you doing, Susie, this morning?
I'm doing fine after shoveling 10 feet.
Swimming through the snow to get here?
I know. But I did say to myself, I am so happy I have a Subaru because I just plowed through a foot of snow. It felt like a foot of snow.
Yeah, it's close to a foot, actually. Yeah. So, it's quite a snowfall we had overnight. Mm-hmm. And people are out there shoveling and blowing snow and plowing snow like crazy right now.
It's very peaceful. It's very quiet. And all the schools are closed, by the way, the public school.
Yes.
And I know the Waldorf school is closed, too. So it's a snow day, folks.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it is.
And I'm sure the people up at Schweitzer and the Winter Carnival people are thrilled, as you can only imagine.
Yeah. And we'll talk about that in a little bit. But first, we have a great show coming today. First, we're going to be talking with Bob Ower. He's the director of the University of Idaho Professional Nonprofit Leadership Certificate Program. And we're also going to have Donna Brundage. She's a student from the program. And this is a program that helps people that are involved with nonprofit organizations get ideas on how to run their organizations more efficiently and successfully.
And then we have a second part.
Yep. Go ahead, Susie.
Okay, we have Matt Nykiel from the Idaho Conservation League. He's the conservation associate. He's going to come in and we're going to talk about the proposed Newport silicone smelter and just see, you know, this finding out some information about what Idaho Conservation League is involved, why they are researching things and getting their information about the smelter. What does it affect and what is their mission in this? So, and I think there's something coming up with the city, so hopefully we'll find out about that, too.
Yeah, February 28th, the city is planning to have a forum on the issue that Mayor Shelby Ronstadt is putting that forum together. But this will be an opportunity to talk about what the smelter is all about, and that's coming up at the bottom of the hour, second half of the show, so hang on for that.
And we can talk about the weather a little bit more. Currently, it's 32 degrees. And we are in a winter storm warning until noon today. That means lots and lots of snow. Interestingly enough, today they're only predicting another 1 to 3 inches. And last night it looks like we had 7 to 10, maybe.
Yes, we did. I think we can all testify that there's a good chunk of snow out there. I'll tell you what's happening up at Schweitzer, because this is golden for skiers, of course. Schweitzer this morning, they do their snow report early, so this is probably like at 5 or earlier. They were reporting 9 inches of new snow at Schweitzer. It's been snowing since then. I'm sure they've had at least an inch. 17 degrees at the summit. It's 23 degrees at this village. Superb powder skiing today at Schweitzer. But they are predicting more snow. They don't know the actual depths that they might get, but more snow tomorrow and on Friday. Temperatures are going to stay. Actually, tomorrow they're going to drop a little bit. They're expecting a high of 17 degrees and a low of 12 degrees tomorrow. And it'll come up a little bit on Friday with a high of 25 and a low of 13 that is predicted up there.
Up at Schweitzer.
At Schweitzer, yes.
I should finish the regular report.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I just stopped talking. Yeah. So we can have a 100% chance of snow up until noon, and then it goes to 50% chance of snow later in the day. High today of 36. Low tonight, 22, with a 40% chance of snow with just a little bit of accumulation. And then Thursday, 10% chance of snow and some sunshine. High of 32. And I think going into the weekend, there's a little bit of snow still coming. So that's down here.
That's down here still, yeah.
So
other things going on outside. The sunrise this morning, if you could have seen the sunrise, it's behind the clouds, of course. It's 6:56 a.m. Sunset tonight will be 5:05. Over the course of the last 7 days, as we're getting closer to spring, we've gained 23 minutes of daylight each day. So the days are definitely getting longer, and we're starting to really notice. Also, up in the skies, we have a new moon on Thursday, but if you're out, you'll see that Venus is becoming visible in the western twilight, probably about middle of this month, and if you were to see it, there would be a waxing moon coming up on Friday. So it's a beautiful time when we have the clear skies, as we actually have had the last week.
What's really interesting, last week I think it was 54 degrees out.
And
then it's now it's we're right in the middle of winter again. Yeah, it's kind of interesting.
Well, that seems to happen every year, that we get a kind of a false start of spring and then winter comes back in. But speaking of winter, mention a few things that are happening around town. Specifically, the big one is Sandpoint Winter Carnival kicks off on Friday. They have the Parade of Lights downtown, starts at 5:30 p.m. And then there's a party after the parade with bonfires they're going to have s'mores and music and fun around the downtown district there. So come on down and catch Winter Carnival this Friday night. Of course, there are a whole bunch of things that are going on during the course of the next 10 days, actually, with Winter Carnival. And we'll swing back to that maybe later in the broadcast.
All right. Well, let's get to our first guest, Bob Over. You're the program director, I'm assuming, of the nonprofit. We're calling it the Professional Nonprofit Leadership Certificate Program through the University of Idaho.
That's right, Susie.
So why don't you tell us a little bit about the program, when it started, how long has it been going on, what does it mean to get a certificate? Why is this program important for the over 6,000 nonprofits in Idaho?
Let me start with your last question first. I think we really believe at the university that the quality of a community is very dependent upon the quality of its nonprofit services within its own borders, and we have a dramatic lack of community-based training for nonprofits throughout Idaho. In fact, through most parts of the country. So that brings up the uniqueness of our program. We're unique because we're the only game in town, basically. We're very unduplicated. We are community-based, and we are year-round. We offer a series of classes in the fall, and we offer a series of classes that are very different in the spring. And in between times, we work with nonprofits, being either board members or staff members or volunteers. So we're accessible 12 months out of the year. So seems to work out well for everybody. So it is indeed very unique.
And how long has this program been going on?
In Idaho, it was born 5.5 years ago, actually. And it came out of a program I was doing at Fort Lewis College in Durango. And I came up here one day and ran into the university almost literally. And we talked about it. And they said, we really want to do something for our community. We want to do an outreach. And maybe this is a mechanism to reach into our community and provide something from the university to enhance the quality of our life throughout our communities.
And Bob, so what kinds of things does a student in the program learn?
We have a wide variety of programs, and I think they probably average somewhere around 40. And each program will be either a one-night stand, or it could be a series of 3 to 5 programs, or 3 to 5 nights. And I think the typical programs we hear about a lot probably are board development, fund development, strategic master planning, you name it, we're doing it, and we get the very, very best of instructors in the area and some out of the area to come in and provide the expertise that's needed for, and it's needed and wanted and asked for. And so all our programs that we offer are by requests from the community itself and a nonprofit sector.
And you've been in business for about 5 years, you mentioned. About how many Sandpoint area nonprofits have taken advantage of this program?
I really don't have a number, Chris, but I can tell you that we have had, over that course of 5.5 years, well over 500 unduplicated students, many of which come from Sandpoint, that have attended classes. And I think the number is actually closer to 600 throughout North Idaho. And we do get students that come in from Montana and from Spokane and as far south as Moscow. And in fact, the popularity of this program is such that we've been asked to do online classes. So we're doing online advanced nonprofit leadership classes. And that started a year ago, and we're full force today out there, and it goes all over the state and wherever else the website would take it.
Is there a particular kind of nonprofit group that you work with? Nonprofit groups cover a wide spectrum. A lot of them are, you know, social services or humanitarian. We're a nonprofit group, KRFY Radio.
That would be like a service organization.
Yeah. Is there a particular type of nonprofit that you work with, or is it across the whole spectrum?
We do cross the whole spectrum. It could be from hospitals to public radio to health and human service organizations to libraries. And we even have business owners and business leaders that come in to take the classes, because we work on leadership and all the qualities and skills that are required to lead an organization. In fact, your radio station has been involved as well. Susie Perez, I know, showed it up at two of our conferences that were right here in our beautiful Sandpoint area.
And we just happened to have Susie Perez right here in the studio.
As a former student, I will tell you, there was so much to gain. And I think folks aren't aware of the fact that a nonprofit is comprehensive. It has a lot of levels and a lot of different things to pay attention to. If you have a functioning board, your organization is going to run better. One of the things that really impressed me, that I really took to heart, was the importance of volunteers in an organization, a nonprofit organization. And it was held at the Panada, and a lot of people attended. It was really fun to hear and learn about the three R's of volunteerism, or volunteer recruitment, retaining those volunteers, and then recognizing the volunteers. Because I know at this station, all our broadcasters are volunteers, and we really wouldn't be a radio station with a local voice on the station if we didn't have volunteer broadcasters. And so it's vital to most nonprofits, the volunteers. So I learned that, amongst other things.
That's true. And in fact, our instructors, which I really believe are the best of the best and the most skilled in the area, also volunteer their time and are available by a phone call, even in mid-July or beginning of September, when we're not necessarily in class session. They're volunteering, they're out there. We all want to contribute something to the quality of our community, and that's what makes Sandpoint and all of North Idaho very, very special.
Mm-hmm. Are the classes aimed more at, like, you say they're for leadership? Is it more for like the executive director of the group, or do you get a lot of people that are board members as well?
Great question. We do get a lot of executive directors, and we also get an equal amount, if not more, board members. And board members that are responsible for the oversight of an organization, they come in for a couple of reasons. One is to learn what they need to be doing as a board member, and then to learn the skills and be able to support and enhance the quality of the staff. Mm-hmm. There needs to be a partnership between staff and board, and this is the best way of doing it. It's to learn together. So, yeah, both board members, other volunteers, and staff members, not only executive directors, but program managers and caseworkers and librarians and so on.
Heads of committees, events coordinators, membership coordinators. There's so many aspects to a nonprofit. When you mentioned the importance of the relationship between an executive director, say, or staff and the board, that can't be stressed enough. So does collaborative leadership come into that relationship?
Totally. There needs to be commonality and common mission and common values and whatever, not only with the staff and the board and volunteers, but with the entire community. This is a community affair. And this is run by the community. In fact, we have a nonprofit leadership committee that is, we call it a council, that is comprised of community leaders as well as leaders from the nonprofit sector, that we look at what we're doing and evaluate it and decide what's coming up next.
Mm-hmm. So I wonder, you know, we probably, everybody in the room has been involved in different kinds of nonprofit groups. Do nonprofit groups come with, we have kind of a problem that we want to try to troubleshoot, and they're looking for help that way through taking this kind of training?
If I understand your question,
do nonprofits come into the class sometime where they're struggling with a particular part of running their organization and they're looking for answers and help?
Oh yeah, and one of the qualities of this kind of program too is that as a class, and our classes could be anywhere from 15 to 40, everybody in the class has a role in answering the questions and resolving the problems of others. So there's a lot of networking, there's a lot of sharing, and there's a lot of learning, not only between the instructor and the students, but between the students and the students. So yes, there's multiple problems with every nonprofit. It's just the nature of the business. It's also the nature of all businesses, conflicts.
It's human nature.
It's really human nature. Yeah. And in fact, we address that in one of our classes coming up here very, very shortly, how to resolve conflict inside an organization and with governmental agencies that might support a nonprofit. And so, yeah, it's conflict resolution. We're going to be doing a class on that as well.
One of the things that I know can happen in probably almost any nonprofit organization is a disconnect between, as I said, staff and the board, or something's going on, a crisis is happening. So if an organization has participated in this program, would they be able to get outside consulting support and continued support after they've taken the classes?
Yeah, and I think that's where our instructors come into play on a volunteer basis. They are available, like I said, year-round, and there's a lot of us up here that are very available and willing and interested and excited to help. And we connect people with people all the time, whether it be other nonprofits or other instructors. And if one of our instructors doesn't have the information, we call another one. So, yeah, nonprofits hopefully feel very supported and valued throughout our community year-round.
And in the certificate program, is it just one semester is the program?
Good question. No. To earn a certificate, one needs to commit to 50 hours of classroom work and involvement. There are no tests. It's just involvement, and so they need active involvement in 50 hours. And once they have achieved that, they will get a certificate of achievement from the university, and that's got a lot of value to it. And what we've learned in the past and currently is that when you have that certificate, it makes you very, very competitive in terms of the job market, as well as enhancing the quality of your organization. So an employer will look at a person that's got a certificate and say, you have gone above and beyond to specialize in nonprofit leadership, and we would like you to be a part of our organization or grow in our organization. And our other guest here, Donna Brundage, is an example of just that.
And that's right, Donna, you just made it in. You've been shoveling snow or trying to get out this morning. And last time we had Mandy Evans, one of your students. Mm-hmm. And this time we have Donna Brundage. So welcome, Donna.
Hi, thanks.
And let's move into that microphone, Donna. It can't hurt you.
All right.
And so welcome, and tell us a little bit about your experience and the organization that you're involved in, and then how this program is helping you in your role in that organization.
Okay, gladly. I started the nonprofit leadership during its first year, and I was actually asked to be on the council. So I've helped almost from day one in terms of organizing, and I've been attending classes for that long. I did obtain the certificate, and I choose to continue going to the classes voluntarily because they're so valuable. Some of the things that the class did for me personally or for my organization, I work for St. Vincent de Paul, and we run Trinity Group Homes, and one of the classes is preparing for grants. So we were able to learn how to get your initial letter submitted and do the initial application, and then we were able to go through a mock interview. And we went through our mock interview with the Inland Northwest Foundation, And that went so well due to the preparation that I received in the class, myself and Clark Richmond, the director of Trinity, we were invited to apply for the full grant, and we just received the full grant in December. So we got $26,000 that our program would not have had had we not attended the classes and networked through this program.
Well, so, congratulations. Yeah. And there's the value.
Exactly.
Part of it.
Part of it. Just yeah, part of it. The networking is the value. Mm-hmm. I'm employed because of the class mm-hmm. where I work.
We asked this question of Bob a little earlier, but were there things that you came in that you specifically wanted to learn because the organization was encountering some troubles or problems they need to figure out?
Well, no, not really. When I initially joined the classes and started taking them, I was on the board of the Human Rights Task Force, and the board was actually pretty well functioning, but there's always room for improvement. So, and there, you know, there were things that we found that we weren't doing. The class is very specific in terms of board development and what role each member of a board plays and how you can develop people into those roles. And then it goes into so many more things, volunteers and grants and fundraising and graphic design and promotion and marketing. I mean, I can't stress enough how valuable attending has been for myself and then the boards. And now because I work in Coeur d'Alene every day, I've actually been asked to join two boards down there recently. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to highly recommend the class to those board members as well.
Mm-hmm. You know, board development is, I know it's an issue for nonprofits across, you know, the whole spectrum, mm-hmm. I'm sure. Because those are volunteers that make a big commitment to these organizations to put in a certain amount of time. So what would be some advice for board development? I mean, what's the kind of things you learned in your class that helped you figure out how to have a good board development program?
Well, one of the things that the class stresses is the role of each board member, the role of the executive director versus the role of the president of the board. What paperwork needs to be filed, the 990s and the registered agents and things like that and all the little specific things. There's classes on budgetary things that boards encounter. But more than anything, I think the class really emphasizes how to have a healthy functioning board, how to know when a board member's been there too long, how to not get into this is the way we've always done it and shut down new ideas. And that's the development part, mm-hmm. because boards do tend to keep members around for years and years and years, and the boards become stagnant. Mm-hmm. And I think the class arms you with the ammunition to make a statement sometimes if that's what you're suffering from, if your board is having issues. Mm-hmm. And conflict resolution. There's, you know, personality types. There's lots of things that the class teaches you about how to become a better functioning group of people.
How about recruitment? Are there techniques to find people that will recharge an organization?
Absolutely. Not only for the board, but also for your organization. Recruiting volunteers is a module. Bob has recruited himself some of the best. Like, people fly in from all over the country and volunteer their time. Sometimes they get a boat ride out of it, but really not much else other than the satisfaction of helping. So his experience that he comes from Colorado, where he ran very successful nonprofits, he has a network of people. Mm-hmm. There's a marketer that flies in from Florida to teach about new techniques with social media and new techniques for presentations and things like that. So, yeah.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Well, Susie. I'm looking at this, your program schedule or your class schedule, and it looks like the January board development training is done. We missed it.
The board development, for the most part, we did a 3 or 4 week session last spring in board development and put a lot of emphasis on that. With that being said, board development is addressed through all our classes anyway, because all the classes are essentially woven together, even though each class will have its own standalone theme. The theme we're emphasizing this spring is fund development, which is critical to all nonprofits, particularly at this point in time.
Mm-hmm. So you have a slate of classes that are coming up for a spring semester. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about those?
Well, we're starting off with something we haven't done before, and we call it the Walt Disney style. And that's a program or a class that deals with leadership qualities. And a lot of the class is going to follow the iconic philosophy of Walt Disney, who is probably one of the greatest leaders we've ever seen. And in fact, there have been over 200,000 books, if you go onto Amazon, on leadership. And Disney stands out as one of the best leadership examples of what can be done. And that's going to be done by Jeff Conroy of St. Vincent de Paul. We're going to do another class, and this is going to be a very exciting class as well. And it's called Effective Messaging, and that's being done by Julie Stratton. Given the example we have presently of our dysfunctional government, Julie's going to address communication. She's going to address how to get people on the same wavelength. She's going to, I'm sure, address divisiveness, which is very prevalent today in our country. And she's going to talk about how we can work together and techniques and thoughts. And she's got stories, and she's an amazing woman. And you don't want to miss this. It's going to be on March 1st. I've had a lot of experience fundraising, an awful lot. And so I'm going to do a four-part series, and I call it The Beggar's Dream, because most fundraisers are thought of as beggars. And it's actually very much the opposite. And so it's a four-part interactive course, and we're going to deal with how to get the money, how to support your organization. And one of those four sessions is going to be an actual workshop, and people will be putting together thoughts and ideas and papers on how to do that. We're also bringing in Christine Meyer, who is the executive director of the Vista Foundation, and Molly Sanchez, who is a program manager at the Inland Northwest Foundation, and they're going to role play with students. And this is where Donna came in.
We got our grant.
Yeah, she and Clark.
The fine art of great job. Learning how to ask, right?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's not easy. It's not easy.
And part of that is, well, we're going to throw in special events. And what I have seen in North Idaho in particular is there's a lot of special events, and some of them are just great. Most of them are not. And you put a lot of time, a lot of effort, a lot of money, manpower, and energy into special events, and you end up with basically nothing. And it starts actually with a special event. It's not a fundraiser, really. It's a marketing tool.
It's an outreach to the community, yeah.
That's exactly right. And Mandy Evans, you spoke of Mandy. Mandy and I are going to be doing that class, and that's going to be, I think, a lot of fun. And then a new instructor we have who's dynamite, it's Carrie Anderson. She's going to be doing a class on donor retention. And I think we all know it's easier to retain a donor and build that financial base, because donors give more and more every year, than to go out and find a new donor. So Carrie's going to talk about techniques and skills on how to keep that donor active and involved and engaged and building up the wealth of an organization. Lastly, we've got a class being done by a guy who's just amazing. His name is Jay Sturgill, and Jay's going to do one called Negotiation Tools. And as we talked about earlier, there's always disagreements and conflicts, et cetera, within a nonprofit and between a nonprofit and others. And I think, you know, going back to what Chris, you were asking, and as well as Susie, there's one of the conflicts we have is, which is really common, is conflicts between boards and staff, specifically the executive director. And that happens in most organizations. So Jay is going to address that, and he's going to address other issues that deal with conflict and misunderstood behavior. So it's a class of nine sessions, and we're offering these at a very, very inexpensive cost. The university is paying for almost all of it, so I call this almost free. I did a class similar to this in Durango. It was $385. This one cost $85.
Wow.
For all sessions, or you can take an individual session for $20.
Heck of an investment. So if people want to get signed up, what do they do?
They go to the website, which is www.uidaho.edu/cda/outreach/nonprofit.
Or if they want to Google it, what would be some keywords that they could get to that website?
They can go on the University of Idaho's website and get a link right to it. Okay. Or they can just put in nonprofit leadership, University of Idaho. Any of those words, I think, would pull this right up.
It seems to me that we're incredibly fortunate to have a class like this for beginning nonprofits, ones that are already so established but haven't put in that foundational work. So how lucky are we in North Idaho and in Idaho in general? So we're kind of out of time, but we want to really thank both of you for coming in. I know it was a hairy ride in, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I really want to thank the guy that's driving the backhoe for the city of Sandpoint because he pushed me out this morning.
Oh, nice.
There's the quality of our community shining brightly.
Yeah. So, yeah. Bob Over and Donna Brundage, thank you so much for coming in and talking to us about the University of Idaho Nonprofit Leadership Program. And if anyone wants to hear more about this or listen to this podcast, you can go to www.krfy.org. We'll have this interview posted. And thank you again for coming in.
We thank you and appreciate the opportunity and privilege to be here.
We're going to come back right after this song with Matt Nykiel from Idaho Conservation League to talk about the silicone smelter in Newport. But right now we're going to hear a song while we change places and move our chairs around. This is Manfred Mann, The Mighty Quinn. It was the number one song on this day in 1968, written by Bob Dylan. And that was Manfred Mann, The Mighty Quinn. And we're back in for the morning show here at 88.5 KRFY. Thanks for listening on this snowy morning. And we have a new guest. Tell us, Chris.
We have Matt Nykiel, and he is a conservation associate with the Idaho Conservation League. Matt, thanks for getting in. Did you have trouble getting here with all that snow we have out there?
No, I don't live too far away, so I had an easy ride in.
Yeah.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, well, good. Where I want to specifically talk about the proposed silicon smelter in Newport, but give us the short version of what the Idaho Conservation League is all about.
Yeah. We are a state-based conservation organization. So we're based out of Boise. We have two field offices, one in Sandpoint and one in Ketchum. And our mission is to protect Idaho's air, water, land, and wildlife throughout the state.
And you have, yeah, and you've been very present here in Sandpoint because you have the field office here in Sandpoint, which is great for our part of the state, that's for sure. So our topic today is the proposed silicon smelter in Newport. And you have been studying the smelter, I'm sure. Can you tell us what the proposal is in brief?
Yeah. So the proposal is in Newport, Washington, which is just across the Idaho-Washington border, a little over half an hour west of Sandpoint. And they're proposing to install a facility that would smelt silica sand that's sourced from British Columbia into silicon metal and sell that for manufacturing of various sorts.
And silicon is used in what types of applications?
Yeah, Hi-Tess, the company, likes to cite that it's used in solar panels, which it is. And it's used, you know, I'm not as familiar with all the various uses of silicon, but my understanding is it's used in sort of like high-tech manufacturing computers and that sort of thing.
And so what's the process that does it take to do the smelting? What's involved with that?
Again, you know, my expertise isn't in the manufacturing of it, but, they will be using what's called a submerged arc furnace and, to smelt something, to smelt, metals and that sort of thing.
Basically melt it down, right?
Yeah. And to do that, you need a lot of energy and electricity to do that. So, high temperatures in a nutshell.
There's a lot of concern about this proposed Newport silicon smelter. I mean, there's groups forming to protest it. But in Idaho Conservation League's mission, you're concerned about the air quality. Are there other concerns too? And what have you found out to date as to the potential impact of the air quality if the smelter does go in, specifically what chemicals would be put into the air. I'm sure you're probably in the initial research stage of this, but what do you know so far about that?
Yeah. So the Idaho Conservation League is concerned about any impact that would happen to the environment, whether it's air quality or water quality or to public lands or to human health too. I think one of our top concerns is air quality. And it's a particular issue in our neck of the woods because we get inversions and the predominant wind pattern would likely blow a lot of the emissions into our part of the state. There are a lot of things that come with a facility like this. And so something that we'll be asking to be evaluated is what sort of truck and train traffic this facility will bring into our area, because part of the furnace that they'll use to smelt the materials will need coal. Coal's part of the process that they'll use to in the smelting process
to heat the high temperatures.
Mm-hmm. And there may be some component in like the smelting, like bringing the metals together. So that
alchemy.
May be part of it too.
Alchemy.
Yeah, and there are also other even wildlife issues, and this is something that I'm still learning more about. But as you both know, we have an endangered species in our area, the woodland caribou, the South Selkirk herd, and they depend a lot on lichen and old growth forests. And lichen happen to be used really commonly as a way to test air quality because they're really sensitive to it. And so one of our concerns is if, depending on where the dispersion of the emissions go, how could it or would it impact lichen growth, and next, how would that impact caribou? And as you know, there are only, they believe, 11 remaining, and people are going to great lengths to try and keep that species going. So there's a lot of concerns, and we try to capture all of them as we review the facility.
On that particular topic of the caribou, the Kalispell tribe is undertaking a program to try to bolster their numbers. They're going to have a captive rearing program that's a pilot program just starting. And I believe the Kalispell tribe has also come out with a position on the smelter already. Is that accurate?
Yeah, I would let them describe their position because I wouldn't want to butcher it. But I know that they're really concerned about the smelter because of all the very similar reasons that ICL is concerned in terms of the environment. Their reservation, their tribal lands are really close to the facility too. So mm-hmm. They're watching the issue closely.
Yeah, their reservation is right there, just downstream from Newport. And of course, this is all their ancestral homeland, is this entire region.
Mm-hmm. So we know that there's the potential for air emissions downwind, which is North Idaho and Sandpoint. But what about emissions into the water, which would be downriver to the Kalispell area and to Washington, and actually up into Canada, because that's where the Pend'oreille River goes into the Columbia?
Yeah. Emissions and how it affects water is something that I'm still learning about. And to some extent, we won't know more until we get more of the data once High Test, the company, has applied for their air permit, and we can know how much exactly they're anticipating to emit. And, another thing that will help us understand that better is Washington will have to conduct what's called a SEPA analysis. SEPA is Washington's state law. It's the State Environmental Policy Act. It requires the state to evaluate all the environmental impacts of a facility, and water impacts would be one of those. And again, that's something that can affect North Idaho as well. You know, we have a lot of high alpine lakes that don't necessarily have the capacity like Lake Pend'oreille might or might not to absorb and take in whatever emissions happen to fall out from the facility.
Mm-hmm. Are there other silicone smelters in North America that have gone online and are smelting with emissions, both water and air, that you can look at or we can look at to see what their track record is, what the impact is?
Yeah, there are several in the United States. I know that some officials from our area have visited similar plants. I believe one is in Mississippi, and I believe there are a few more in the Northeast. I've been reaching out to similar environmental groups to see if they've tracked, you know, what their air permits are like, what their compliance is like. And it's actually been sort of interesting. There just aren't a lot of groups who are tracking that sort of thing. And so I haven't been able to get a lot of, you know, secondhand experience. But there are examples in the United States that we can look to see what their track record is like and how it might come to play out here in Idaho.
At this point in time, where are we at in the process of them obtaining their permit? I know they purchased the land. We're talking about High Test, who we'd also like to have in the studio and come and talk to us at some point in time. But where are we at in the process?
So it's pretty complicated, but the High Test, the company, hasn't yet applied for their air permits. They haven't started the Washington State Environmental Policy Act review process yet. Right now, they are having to go what's called to develop an air modeling protocol. So it essentially means here's our plan at looking at what air quality is like and how it will potentially be impacted by the facility. And the Washington State Department of Ecology has been going back and forth with High Test to say, is your protocol sufficient? And if not, what do you need to do to make it more sufficient? And that's one thing that ICL has been advocating for is we think the protocol should include site-specific weather data so that essentially High Test should install the instruments necessary to take site-specific weather data from where they believe the facility will be installed and to see how the weather would impact the emissions throughout an entire year, depending on, you know, winter, spring, summer, fall. To my knowledge, the company hasn't agreed to do that yet. And we're still waiting to hear what the Washington Department of Ecology decides, whether or not that should be required or whether or not they're going to approve of the modeling as is. So just to wrap up succinctly, the company hasn't applied for their permits yet, and they're still in sort of this pre-permitting phase. There are also other things that they will have to do in terms of land use. The property that they own for the facility hasn't yet been rezoned to allow them to build an industrial facility like that. They'll also need a conditional use permit to do all this. So they have a long way to go, and that's not to say that, you know, we shouldn't all just sort of sit back idly by and not continue to engage and pay attention, but it is to say that there's still some steps in the permitting world that the company will have to take.
I think it's coincidental, but a new proposal that has popped up is an exploratory drilling for a silicon mine that's east and kind of south of Lake Pend'Oreille. Are these two things associated in any way?
We really don't know. We're not sure if there's any connection. And it's hard to tell. For one, there was a meeting at the Forest Service Ranger Station last week, and officials from the company that would be conducting the exploratory drilling, it's called Pend'Oreille Silica Inc., didn't attend to, you know, clear up questions like that or to answer other questions. So it's hard to tell, for one, because they didn't show up. We just really don't know if there's a connection.
Okay. And that's, again, it is kind of a separate issue. They're going through a permit just to do the exploratory drilling. I assume that is to determine if it's even economically feasible to put a mine in at that point. But it's kind of interesting. We have these two things that have popped up just in the last year and a half or so. Mm-hmm. So what's the next step with the proposal in Newport for the smelter? What is ICL trying to propose or want people to know at this point?
Yeah. Well, we are encouraging folks on our website. You can find it at www.idahoconservation.org. It's all one, Idaho Conservation is one word, but we're encouraging folks to continue to call into the Washington Department of Ecology and request that that site-specific weather weather data be collected as sort of the pre-process before the high test company can move forward in permitting for their air permit. And we're also going to be including in the next several days a request that people ask that the Department of Ecology also have as a part of this modeling considerations for the impacts to lichen and how that could affect caribou species. So we're hoping that we've been getting a lot of people to call in, which is super helpful, and the Department of Ecology is really taking those comments to heart. So we think it's having an impact, and we're encouraging folks to continue to do that.
Are you going to send out a blast to kind of put that in place?
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And if they want to go to your website, what is that again?
It's idahoconservation.org.
Okay, and there's information on there. I heard when Mayor Shelby Ronstad was here that there was going to be some kind of a city forum to bring information together with all, like, 8 different participants. Is that still happening? Do you know anything about that?
Yeah, so to my knowledge, that's still the plan. And the proposed date is Wednesday, February 28th. 5:30. I don't know if they've settled on a setting for that yet, but the goals, like you say, to inform and empower the public. There will be some Q&A amongst several panelists and then some Q&A from the audience.
I think there's a lot of misinformation out there. And just as you said, when you're informed, you're empowered. And so there's a lot of opportunities to find out more because we're really just getting our getting this information to the public. And so here's another opportunity. Go to idahoconservation.org.
And there will be more information on the forum out there. It is the date. That date is, I think, pretty well set for the 28th. And I don't know the venue either.
I went to the city site and I couldn't find anything.
Yeah, it's they're still forming up the details.
Okay.
At this point, I don't believe HITEST has said they're coming. But I do believe that they have a commitment from the Washington Department of Ecology to have a representative there, which could speak to an awful lot of these more technical questions that people would have.
And timelines.
One thing that's interesting that I've observed so far, that people are already making up their mind, even though there's a lot of information yet to be discovered, is that this seems to be crossing the usual political lines, that there are people that are very conservative in town. They're saying no smelter, which you would normally associate with, you know, pro-industry, pro-growth sorts of things, and they don't want to see it. And, of course, the people that are more liberal, who have environmental concerns, you would typically think don't want to see it. Are you observing the same sort of thing, Matt?
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting issue for that reason exactly. I think it's highlighting what's kind of inspiring in a way that, you know, we all really care about this place that we live despite our political differences. And despite those differences, we all want folks to follow certain rules that we can all agree upon that make sure our air and our land and our water are protected. And, you know, I think it's heartening to see our political representatives speaking out too. For example, Representative Heather Scott from our area has encouraged that NEPA, the National Environmental Policy Act, be used to help us understand what are the impacts that this facility could present. And I think environmental evaluation is always a good thing to make sure we're aware of what could happen. I will say that it's also highlighting concerns that are national in the sense that we have budget proposals that would dramatically slash the EPA. And, you know, even though Washington has good environmental regulations, all states that have air programs rely on the EPA for help to monitor technical expertise and just making sure that facilities are following the rules. And part of, you know, if you're suggesting that we have, you know, a strong NEPA analysis, one of EPA's major roles is that they review and comment on any federal agency's environmental analysis. And if the EPA doesn't have a strong budget and they're cutting employees, they're not going to have the capacity to make sure that we're doing those sorts of evaluations in the best possible way that we can. And so I think this is an issue that helps us understand that, you know, our common interests require us to have certain reasonable and strong environmental rules in place and agencies that can help make sure those rules are followed.
I think one of the things I've been hearing is some people say, if that goes in, I can't live here. I already have health problems with air, with breathing. And I think that there we're still at a point that if you get information and you get educated about this, you can, as you say, call the EPA in Washington or the environmental groups in Washington, get involved and have a say in the outcome of this situation.
Yeah, and in particular, right now, a lot of the ball is in the Washington Department of Ecology's court. And so if folks are interested and they want to engage and they're concerned, the Washington Department of Ecology, and specifically Grant Pfeiffer, who will hopefully be at this smelter panel, they've been really receptive to hearing people out and hearing their concerns. And I think that's a great thing. And for folks, I think it's a great thing for folks to continue to reach out
and become an advocate for what you want and believe in.
Yeah,
exactly. An opportunity. I like the fact also, as you said, common ground here. Mm-hmm. It's about our quality of life and our lifestyle here in North Idaho. So,
yeah.
Matt Nykiel, thank you so much from the Idaho Conservation League. We're going to have you back in here next Wednesday talking about the retiring of a coal plant with Emily Cleveland.
Looking forward to it.
Okay, mm-hmm. Next Wednesday. Mm-hmm. So thank you so much for coming in, Idaho Conservation League. And we have just enough time to go out with a song. This is The Byrds. It's called Hungry Planet. So we all hope you have a great day. Stay safe out there. Shovel snow. That's what we're up to today.
Travel safely.
Bye-bye.